the following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hi, everybody. Coming up, Nicole tells your fortune, looking ahead. So get out your crystal and stay tuned with Mistress Nicole. All dressed in leather, you won't forget her. You want to love her and you won't let go. Who's that woman, crazy woman, Nicole?
All right. Welcome to a Friday, everybody. Oh, I just love it when Friday comes around, you know, because we got a weekend. Tomorrow, by the way, if you're in South Florida, I'm going to be out and about tomorrow in a, there's a fall festival out on the river in Fort Lauderdale, across from the Museum of Discovery and Science, across from the Broward Center. So noon to four, wish the rain away. No rain, no rain, no rain. So if you're around, come by. It should be a nice day, I think. We hope. Anyway, welcome to a Friday. So yesterday was all about the hearing. And we'd been saying, because we'd been told that it's likely the last of the January 6th hearings, certainly before the election. However, because of what happened at the end of the hearings yesterday, I don't think it's over. I think there will be at least one more, hopefully with the former guy testifying. That's not going to happen. It would be nice, wouldn't it? Yeah, I think. Okay, this is weird. We are, okay, supposed to have a guest. I think, well, I'll just keep watching for him and hopefully he'll join in soon. It's not working? You got no sound, huh? Let's see if it's, it should be there. David, if it's not, what is going on? There's something weird going on with Progressive Voices too. I don't know. Oh, it's a Friday. Can you tell it's a Friday? Oh my goodness. Let me try one other thing. I hate when things don't work the way they're supposed to. Let me try one thing. Sorry, I know this is not, you know, great radio. I'll tell you what, let's start with my contention that Nancy Pelosi is, what is this? This is not for today. Oh, God. Okay. Everything is like, oh, here he is. Okay, I guess this year. So Nancy Pelosi is a badass. Let me just say that. With everything that happened on January 6th, I am, I have a newfound respect for Nancy Pelosi. You know, there are certain things about Nancy that I appreciate, some that I don't so much. But I got to tell you, after seeing how she remained cool under pressure, how she just took control when everything was crumbling around her, I have a newfound respect for Nancy Pelosi. Let me just play this one very quick clip, and then I see our guest is here, so we'll join him in just a moment. But this was Nancy Pelosi when she was trying to get somebody to come help them at the Capitol as they were under siege, and she was told that Donald Trump wanted to go to the Capitol. So this is how it all played out, like this. Ah, hold on, I gotta hit the right button. Oh man, okay, here we go. Goes like this.
Secret Service said they have dissuaded him from coming to Capitol Hill. They told him they don't have the resources to protect him here. So at the moment he is not coming, but that could change.
Oh, he comes. I'm going to punch him out. I'm waiting for this, for trespassing on the Capitol grounds. I'm going to punch him out, and I'm going to go to jail, and I'm going to be happy.
Oh, she's just in her element. Nancy Pelosi deserves a round of applause for that, because that was, she just showing that she's a badass. Good on Nancy Pelosi. I appreciate that. All right. So we got a lot of details yesterday, a lot of details that we didn't have before, all leading to the fact that this former twice impeached failed president really wanted to remain in office at any cost. He would have done anything in his power or beyond to not give up the power. So I was thinking, I wonder if any other transition in history has been as fraught. Isn't that funny how that happens? We just coincidentally have the perfect guest on the show today to tell us about that. In fact, you know what? My whole thing here is messed up. Let me bring in our guest this way. I'm not set up for this. Hold on one second, David. I'm doing it a different way today.
Take your time.
David Marchuk. And I have sound coming from that computer as well. Give me one second. It's a Friday. Can you tell? Now I have a lot of David and not much of me. So hold. I will get the picture together. In the meantime, hi, David Marchuk. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it is my pleasure. So you are you are the expert on presidential transitions, and you are that because of a job that you held for a while where you ran the Center for Presidential Transitions, the Partnership for Public Services Center for Presidential Transitions. I wasn't even aware that that was a thing, but it is indeed a thing. And so here we go. All right. Now I think I'm going to have both of us on this. No, we're not. Anyway, David, I will get the video set, but welcome to the show. I'm so sorry that it's all screwy at the beginning. It won't be in a moment. I promise.
I made worse technical errors, so this is nothing.
You know, this is what happens. I'm my own producer and engineer and everything else. And once in a while, I think I'm being so clever that I'm going to figure it out and I screw it all up. But I'll get it fixed in just a moment. So tell us about this job that you held. What did it entail aside from the podcast that we're going to talk about in a second?
So the Partnership for Public Service is a nonpartisan nonprofit focused on making government better, more efficient, more productive, and supporting the important role that government plays. You know, government officials are maligned, criticized, and actually they keep us safe, they keep us healthy, and they do very important work. So, of course, government agencies and government processes can get better, but the Partnership for Public Service is focused on highlighting the good that the government does and also making it better. Part of making government better is for presidents to be more effective, and part of presidents being more effective is for them to have a good start, and that's a transition. So the way our Constitution works, there's a period of time between the election and the inauguration. It's typically 75 days. And a president has a boatload of work to do during that period of time. It's almost impossible to get it done. And so the Partnership for Public Service has been focused on encouraging candidates for president to plan early, start transition planning, hire a big team, and get ready as if they're going to be president on election day so that they can take office and run on January 20th.
Right. And usually there's cooperation, from what I understand from your book. By the way, we're up and running now. Sorry about that.
Right.
Okay. That the gold standard for presidential transitions was between George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton?
George W. Bush and Barack Obama.
I knew it was one of those.
I'll tell you the story here. I mean, We've had some bad transitions. Hoover to Roosevelt, Buchanan to Lincoln. We can talk about those.
Let's talk
about a good transition to start.
Okay, cool.
So you called George W. Bush, took office in the year 2000 after a bitter, divided, litigated election, which ended with a difference of 537 votes in one state that determined the electoral vote and ultimately went to the Supreme Court of the United States. That outcome was not determined until December 12th or 13th. So George W. Bush only had 35 days for his transition. He took office January 20th. 8 months later, two planes hit the World Trade Center. One hit the Pentagon and one crashed in Pennsylvania, the worst terrorist attack in the United States history. He didn't have time to get all his national security staff in place because of the shortened transition. So the 9/11 commission studied, analyzed, and dissected what happened on September 11th and in advance. and found that the shortened transition imperiled his ability to get his national security team in place and therefore imperiled our national security. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to his seventh year in office, just like Harry Truman said when FDR kept him in the dark, he handed it over to Eisenhower. George W. Bush said, whoever comes after me, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, I want them to be ready. And so he instructed his then chief of staff, Josh Bolten, to roll out the red carpet for whomever won. And he worked equally with Obama and McCain, even though he supported John McCain.
Wow.
Fast forward to the election. At the time of the election, when Obama won in 2008, we had two wars going on and a financial crisis. And that collaboration between outgoing President Bush, who was very unpopular at the time, and incoming President Obama actually helped to reduce the impact of the financial crisis, reduce the number of Americans that lost their houses, and helped accelerate the economic recovery faster than it would have been had we not had that cooperation.
Wow. So George W. Bush, having not been afforded that, I was going to say luxury, but it's not a luxury. It's a necessity.
It's not a luxury. Yeah.
Right. Said, I'm not going to make that mistake. I'm going to make sure this is a smooth transition, and did assure that.
Exactly.
And as much as I dislike George W. Bush and his policies and literally everything about him, I think up until Donald Trump, he might have been our worst president ever. I commend him for that. Because in a democracy, one of the hallmarks of a real democracy is the peaceful transfer of power. It's just a given. Now, you mentioned there were two others that were not so great, and you write about them. So before we get to those stories, let's talk about the book, because this new book is out. It's called The Peaceful Transfer of Power, An Oral History of America's Presidential Transitions. And I mentioned when you came on, David Marchik, that you were the director of the Partnership for Public Services Center for Presidential Transition. As such, you hosted its Transition Lab podcast. That was a year-long podcast series dealing with the history of presidential transitions.
Yes, it probably was not as popular as the Nicole Sandler show.
Well, it might have been.
In Washington, it actually kind of took off. Politico said it was their favorite podcast of that cycle. And what we did is, because the subject of a smooth handover of power is so fundamental for our democracy, we wanted to use the podcast to educate the American public, educate Congress, educate experts, and educate those that would go into the government. And so what we did is we analyzed every single modern transition from Carter forward with former chiefs of staff or former senior officials in those transitions and the administration. So we had Jim Baker, who was chief of staff for Ronald Reagan,
right.
Josh Bolten, chief of staff for George Bush, John Podesta, who was chief of staff for Bill Clinton, Dennis McDonough, who was chief of staff for Barack Obama.
Right.
And then we had historians like Ken Burns and Eric Rauchway and Ted Widmer talk about the historic transitions.
Right.
Buchanan to Lincoln, Hoover to Roosevelt. And one thing that Ken Burns said that I'll never forget, he said, in the 233 years since John Adams took the reins from George Washington, we've had presidents that lost, we've had presidents that didn't want to go, but we've never had a president that didn't leave. And then he went on to say, we've never had troops alerted, shots fired, and nobody died. That was before 2020.
Wow. Wow. And some of these were the two that we'll talk about were pretty intense. So it's astounding when you think about it. So you did that, and those podcasts basically form the basis for this book, which you say is
Correct.
An oral history. It's an oral history,
yes.
Because they came from the interviews that you did on the podcast. So the book is newly out. Perfect timing, of course, just as, you know, perfect timing for us to talk today. Now, when we set this, we didn't know that the possibly last hearing was going to be the day before we speak. And you know, the more with each you know, progressive hearing, we learn so much more. Just the video we saw last night of for that Nancy Pelosi's daughter shot. She happened to be there for this historic occasion shooting it, and she got a different kind of history on film. First of all, it brings back the moment, which it must have been terrifying for them because it was terrifying for us at home. As you're watching this unfold, knowing that you've covered presidential transitions, one, did you ever expect you'd see anything like this in your lifetime? And two, what goes through your head at a moment like this?
So I never thought I'd see anything in my lifetime like this. And it was one of the worst days in history, a day that will live in infamy. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'll tell you a story which is in the book and also was profiled in this week's Vanity Fair. So we had been quiet, and I'm not a Trump fan.
Nor am I.
But I had a job to do, and my job was to work with both sides on a nonpartisan basis. And I did that faithfully and to the letter of the job. So we had been working with both the Biden campaign and the Trump White House. And there was a fellow in the Trump White House named Chris Liddell, mm-hmm. who was deputy chief of staff. And he's a foreign business executive. He was CFO of Microsoft and CFO of General Motors. He's a staunch Republican, but he, more than supporting one party or one president, he supported the Constitution. And he was in charge of planning for either Trump's second term or Trump leaving office, consistent with the law. There's a Presidential Transition Act, which every president is required to implement. Mm-hmm. We had been working quietly with him. He did a really good job behind the scenes. He stayed out of the Oval Office and basically said, I want Trump to win. I'm working for Trump. But if he doesn't win, we have an obligation to the country to have a peaceful and smooth transition of power. On January 6th, we had a number of conversations with Chris. He wanted to quit. And my friend Josh Bolton, with whom I worked, and he was Bush's chief of staff and really set the gold standard for transitions, he spoke with Chris that night, and in the Vanity Fair article, Josh describes Chris as weeping with what he was seeing on TV, and he wanted to leave. He felt his reputation was attacked. He felt this was one of the worst days in history. And Josh and I implored him not to leave. We said, if you leave, nobody will be there to do your job. You've done a good job, and you can help land this plane that is burning. And luckily, he stayed the next 14 days and helped the smooth and peaceful transfer of power. And actually, even though he didn't support Biden, didn't like Biden, he had a job to do under the Constitution, and he did it. And for that, he's really a hero.
But
One of the stories we tell in the book.
Great. But the rest of the administration, they take their orders from the top, and Donald Trump was not playing. I mean, we all remember the picture of him sitting in the Oval Office after he inexplicably won the Electoral College vote. He didn't win the popular vote. I feel compelled to say that all the time. But still, when Barack Obama welcomed him in, did all the things he was supposed to do, left him the letter, which, by the way, Trump stole on the way out. It doesn't belong to him. It belongs to the office, not to him. He doesn't believe in following the rules. And so a lot of people who worked for him also didn't believe in following the rules, or they believed in it taking their orders from the president. Thankfully, there are some people who understand that they don't serve the man. They serve the office. They serve the Constitution. They serve the nation. Donald Trump never got that memo, or just never read the Constitution, or doesn't understand how it works. When did it become apparent that he wasn't participating in a transition the way they are historically carried out?
It became apparent the day after the election. So you recall the election happened on a Tuesday. Mm-hmm. That night he said, I won, and if I didn't win, it's rigged.
Right.
By Saturday of that week, Arizona had come out with the results. Georgia had come out with results. We knew Biden won. Mm-hmm. At that moment, there's a kind of off the books, not very well known process called ascertainment, sure. which is when the head of a small agency called the General Service Administration, at, quote, ascertains, that's the word under the law, that there's an apparent winner in the election, and that's when the formal transition is supposed to begin. That official did not do that, despite the fact that it was absolutely clear that Joe Biden had won the election. And that uncertainty, that lack of cooperation continued until, I think, December 12th or 13th. So Joe Biden had the same shortened transition as George W. Bush, which hurt our country in the year 2000.
Right.
Fortunately, the Biden transition team anticipated everything. They anticipated a delay. They anticipated non-cooperation. They anticipated not being able to get access to the agencies. They anticipated not being able to cooperate on the COVID vaccine distribution, and they planned for it. Mm-hmm. Ted Kaufman, who ran the transition, deserves enormous credit. There's one thing they didn't anticipate: January 6th.
Right.
Otherwise, they had every scenario laid out and had a mitigating strategy for it.
Except, you know, again, as the January 6th hearings are going on, we learn more. And yesterday, we got to hear the words of Steve Bannon on, I believe it was a week before Election Day. He apparently is on a call with, the description is, some colleagues in China. So he's talking to Chinese nationals, I guess, and he laid out exactly what their plan was. And this is what he said.
And what Trump's going to do is just declare victory, right? He's going to declare victory. But that doesn't mean he's the winner. He's just going to say he's the winner. The Democrats, more of our people vote early that count. Theirs voted mail. And so they're going to have a natural disadvantage, and Trump's going to take advantage of it. That's our strategy. He's going to declare himself a winner. So when you wake up Wednesday morning, it's going to be a firestorm. Also, if Trump is losing by 10 or 11 o'clock at night, it's going to be even crazier. No, because he's going to sit right there and say they stole it. I'm directing the Attorney General to shut down all ballot places in all 50 states. It's going to be no. He's not going out easy. Trump, if Biden's winning, Trump is going to do some crazy shit.
As you know, Mr. Bannon refused.
Steve Bannon said it, the quiet part out loud, and now we hear it. We knew that was their strategy. Trump knew in 2017 that if he lost, he was going to claim he won, that he was going to say it was stolen. And yet so much of this country believes him. These people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, I actually feel sorry for most of them because they're like sheep who were led along by this guy, and they're believing. He's their president. He told them the election was stolen, that he won by a landslide, and they're thinking they have to go protect the future of the nation. I have this thing I call opposite world. It's opposite world on a meta basis. I mean, it's nothing that we could have imagined before, yet this is how he does things. How do you deal with that on an institutional level? How do the people, you know, who they call the deep state, I'll call public service employees, how do they deal with something like this?
So prior to the election, under the leadership of Chris Liddell and also a career civil servant named Mary Jabird, who was the head of the transition operation for the government, they did what was required under the law. They developed briefing materials. They developed plans for the smooth handover. They created office space for the Biden team and did everything required under the law. All of that was put to a halt the day after the election by this decision not to move forward with the ascertainment, not to move forward with the formal transition. Once the formal transition began, you know, essentially 6 weeks late, most officials in the government cooperated. Mm. Most Trump officials, most agencies did cooperate. There were a few that did not, including important agencies like the Department of Defense, which protects our national security, the Office of the United States Trade Rep, and also the Office of Management and Budget, which is the budget office for the United States.
Right.
And so, you know, it was a terrible transition in some senses, because While the Biden team was very prepared and did a great job, while there were people like Chris Liddell and Mary Jabert that did a great job, there were also a lot of folks that did not implement what they were supposed to do under the law.
Yeah. There was that moment as the Bidens, you know, they get out of the car for the last stretch of the parade, the march from, you know, the Capitol up to the White House. They get to the front door. The door is not only closed, it's locked. That's part of the transition, isn't it? I mean, somebody did that. Somebody was making a major statement there, weren't they? Or am I reading too much into it?
I'm not aware of that story.
You can see the
video. I would
say
that there have been only four times in U.S. history when the outgoing president has not showed up for his successor's inauguration.
Yeah.
John Adams, John Quincy Adams, Andrew Johnson, and now Donald Trump. And so, you know, the John Adams and John Quincy Adams elections were disputed and very hotly contested. You recall that Thomas Jefferson won his presidency through a vote in the House of Representatives. Andrew Johnson, who was not a great president, was the last president not to show up until Donald Trump.
It's unbelievable. But, you know, I guess it's hard to qualify in order which was the worst. I was thinking there can't be anything that was as bad as what we experienced because we experienced it. But you do write about two fraught transitions in history, Buchanan to Lincoln and Hoover to Roosevelt. So what happened? What should we know about those?
So I'll tell you the story, and then there are also some similar themes, particularly in the Roosevelt to Hoover to Roosevelt. So Buchanan to Lincoln was by far the worst transition ever. Then the transition period, the period between the election and the inauguration, was 4 months. The 20th Amendment was passed in 1933, and that moved the inauguration date to January 20th. And in those 4 months, seven states seceded from the Union.
Wow.
Half of the cabinet declared their loyalty to the South. Many in the cabinet said that we should recognize the South. Jefferson Davis was elected president of the Confederacy. And Abraham Lincoln was in some far off place called Springfield, Illinois, without the ability to really communicate or do much at all. He took a train trip to Washington, which is highlighted in the book. There's a wonderful book by Ted Widmer, who wrote Lincoln on the Verge. And in that 13 days, Lincoln found his voice. He gave over 100 speeches in front of huge crowds, 75,000 in Buffalo and almost a million people in New York City. And he developed his themes that became the centerpiece of his presidency about keeping the Union together, about appealing to our better angels, and the themes of the Gettysburg Address. But that was the worst transition in history.
Well, yeah, I mean, the country, states seceded in civil war, and that's pretty bad. One could argue that we came pretty damn close, but not to that extent. It's not; it wasn't as widespread.
Well, I don't think anything can compare to the Civil War,
right?
With which was the bloodiest war in American history.
But this
let's
is not
talk about
over
Hoover
yet.
To Roosevelt, though.
okay, let's do that
again.
Yes.
4 months, like 2020, we're in the throes of a recession. That was the Great Depression. At the time Biden was elected, we had 11 million people out of work. We had a COVID crisis, a global pandemic. We had a racial reckoning in the wake of Floyd's murder. And we obviously had the climate crisis.
Right.
So, and a political crisis. But in 1932 to 1933, the Great Depression peaked. We had bank runs and closures in 25 states where people couldn't get their money out of banks. We had houses being foreclosed at a high rate. Hitler came to power. The Reichstag burned. Japan pulled out of the League of Nations, starting their imperial march. And meanwhile, Hoover would not cooperate with Roosevelt. As you recall, Roosevelt was in a wheelchair from polio. Hoover thought he was of weak mind, just like he was of weak body. And he belittled Roosevelt. His idea of working on the transition was to try to convince Roosevelt to abandon the New Deal. And so Eric Rauchway, the historian that tells the story in the book, he wrote a book called Winter's War, a wonderful book. And I asked him, why'd you write this book? There are thousands of books on Roosevelt. And he said, I wanted to write a book on the transition because the 100 days after Roosevelt took office, when 15 pieces of legislation were passed that formed the New Deal, I felt that the 100 days before the election were as important as the 100 days after. One other thing happened. There was an assassination attempt against Roosevelt in Miami, where the mayor of Chicago was actually hit with a bullet. So that was a bad transition.
Yeah.
The historians that I interviewed for the book debated actually which was the worst transition, 1932 to 33 or 2020. And, you know, again, as Ken Burns said, shots were fired, troops were alerted, people died in 2020. Mm-hmm. It was a bad transition. Luckily, the Biden team did a good job.
Thank goodness, right? By the way, I should mention, Ken Burns also wrote the foreword for the book.
He did, thankfully.
He does is great. So it's definitely informative. It's interesting. Look, we could go around in circles, which was worse. I guess it doesn't matter. The fact that we're living through this one, and as I said before, it's not over yet. Because Donald Trump has not given up his attempt to retake power. He's still claiming, look, he issued a 14-page response today to yesterday's hearing to the fact that he was subpoenaed by the committee at the end of the hearing. He didn't answer whether or not he would actually show up. He didn't put forth any facts to back up his many claims. He just kept making the claims, false claims, that he won the election, that it was stolen. The lies, the same lies over and over again. This is where I think we're different. I could be wrong because I'm not a historian. I was not a great student. But I think in the past, even the worst players, they gave to the facts. They said, okay, we'll give you this. This happened, this happened, this happened. But today, this class of Trumpers or maggots or whatever you want to call them, they will lie and everybody else will swear to that lie. You heard Steve Bannon say it. It doesn't matter. Even if he lost, he's going to claim he won. That was their strategy all along. I always say I can't debate a Republican because they won't agree to the ground rule. Sky is blue, grass is green. When you can't get even that kind of agreement, we're so separated, we're living in two different universes, thus opposite world. How do you deal with people like that when you can't trust? Look, there's a controversy in Arizona because what person I think is a legitimate candidate for governor, Katie Hobbs, will not debate Carrie Lake, who is this nut job of a candidate, Republican, who lies about everything. And she said the same thing that I say. If you can't agree, you can't stipulate to ground rules, to facts, I can't debate her. She lies about everything. But now she's getting criticized because she won't debate this woman who's a pathological liar. I don't know how you rectify that and go forward.
Well, I guess in the world of presidential transitions historically, and I'll probably give you a boring answer that does not appeal to your viewers, this part of the world has traditionally been nonpartisan, where people that disagree fundamentally over everything come together in support of the peaceful transition of power. And part of the essence of the book is appealing to what President Lincoln called the better angels and getting back to that bipartisan, nonpartisan tradition. I'll give you one other example. Again, I realize that you're not a fan of George Bush. I didn't vote for him. He did a good job on the transition. He did what was in our nation's interest. I'll give you a perfect example. Josh Bolton, his chief of staff, organized what was called a tabletop exercise, basically a scenario playing exercise where the outgoing National Security Advisor, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, met with the incoming Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, Secretary of Defense. So Hillary Clinton met with Condoleezza Rice, the outgoing National Security Advisor and the Defense Secretary. Actually, the Defense Secretary was the same person because Obama kept Bob Gates.
Right. I remember that. Yep.
They set January 20th, this transition is a period of great vulnerability for our country. Let's And at the tick of noon, one president goes out and another comes in. And we know that our adversaries want to take advantage of the United States. So let's plan, even though Obama ran against Bush, essentially the entire Obama campaign was against Bush. Mm-hmm. Bush was big enough to say, we have to put country first before party. So they did this scenario planning. The subject they picked was how to prevent a terrorist attack or to deal with a terrorist attack on the United States during the transition.
Wow.
On January 19th, there was a credible threat of a terrorist attack by some Somali nationals against the United States on the mall during the inauguration.
Wow.
And the outgoing Bush national security team and the incoming Obama national security team worked in the Oval Office and worked in the Situation Room to figure out how do we prevent it? And if it happens, how do we react? Mm-hmm. And that's the type of bipartisan, nonpartisan cooperation that is very typical in transitions. And that's what I hope we can return to.
Well, David Marchuk, you even, you know, I called them, I forget what I called them, dedicated public employees. But you said they're career civil servants. These are who the right calls the deep state. But the fact of the matter is most of them are nonpartisan players who work in Washington. They make sure the machine functions. They are nonpartisan. They are, I guess, they're government workers. They make sure it runs the way it's supposed to. But so Trump wanted to change the designation of the civil servants' employment so that he could fire them at will and replace these people with loyalists so they could do his bidding. That would be really dangerous. That's who they call the deep state, right? I mean, my brain freezes with this stuff because it just doesn't make sense. They're vilifying the people who we depend on to do the work to keep the country running. Am I wrong?
So Trump was partially ineffective because he undermined the very people that would implement his policies. So in my experience, federal civil servants do what they're told. Mm-hmm. They are there to implement the president's wishes. The president is elected by the people, and the president gets determined with the Congress and within the normal checks and balances, the policies of the United States government. Civil servants will give you good advice. They'll debate the pros and cons. They'll give you their perspective on history. But they ultimately will do what their leaders tell them to do and implement policies so long as they're consistent with the law. And so this actually hurt Donald Trump because he hollowed out the government in many ways. And he did have a proposal to essentially eliminate some of the civil service protections, which were put in place to protect the institutions of government from abuses of power, and to protect the checks and balances that our founders so artfully created. Our government is imperfect. And as Winston Churchill said, you know, Americans will always do the right thing after they've exhausted all the other alternatives.
Right.
And so our government's not perfect. It's inefficient. There are problems. A friend of mine flew into the country yesterday and had to stand in line for his get his passport stamped for 2.5 hours. But by and large, our civil servants do a good job. They're patriotic. They want to do the right thing. And in my experience, having been in the Clinton administration and the Biden administration, the most effective leaders of agencies know how to work with civil servants to get the most out of them. They're highly qualified. And that's part of the essence of what the Partnership for Public Service does, to support and protect the civil service of the United States.
I see. And so I do have it right. When they talk about the deep state, they're talking about civil servants. They're talking about people who've worked in the government for years. They're conflating it to, oh, these are people who are so dug in, they have an agenda. But you're saying they're not. They don't have agenda. Their agenda is to serve the country, right? Is there evil in the deep state?
I have not seen it. What I found is that the civil servants are dedicated to doing what's right, implementing the law, and pursuing what is, you know, the policy of whoever is elected by the people of the United States.
So you've been immersed in the world of transitions. We'll finish up here. Do you worry going forward that things are going to get worse, that there are going to be more Trumps, or worse, that he could get in again, and that the process will be upended? Or is there a way to safeguard it to make sure what happened in 2020 doesn't happen again?
So I'm an optimist. I basically believe that we'll return to the norms. I think that the last 4 years were a historic aberration in terms of norms. We've had presidents that have been wildly unpopular on the left and on the right. But what we saw in the last 4 years was outside the norms, and including on January 6th, which is, you know, one of the worst days in American history.
Yep.
There are things that Congress can do to make it better, to make transitions smoother, faster. They can clarify the legal standard to start the formal transition. They can move the dates up. They can provide more funding for staff, for presidents, for candidates. And the law already encourages presidents to plan in advance, but the Congress could do more to support the peaceful transition of power. And that's part of what the essence of the book highlights.
And the book is The Peaceful Transfer of Power: An Oral History of America's Presidential Transitions. David Marchick compiled it based on the interviews you did on the podcast that was a year-long project dealing with transitions. I don't know if you saw it or not. Every day I do a little show card and a little, you know, graphic for the program. Today's is an old political cartoon, and I'm bad. I didn't make note of who the cartoonist is, and I can't read it here because it's too small, but I will find it. And it's signed. I'm going to put it up on the screen so you can see. It's a peaceful, P-I-E-C-E, full transition of power. And there's Trump holding on to the presidential seal with the Constitution ripped up all around him. That's not the kind of peaceful transition we want. We want a real, the kind that is what democracies thrive on, live on. David Marchick, thank you for doing this. That must have been a great job doing that podcast. It must have been fascinating.
It was fascinating. And I think the work of the Partnership for Public Service helps the country. And I was happy to be part of that.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for writing the book. It's a great reference. And it was nice meeting you. Thank you for coming on today. And sorry about
all the
gremlins at the beginning. Really appreciate it. You take care.
Bye-bye.
There you go. David Marchick. Fascinating stuff. I mean, look, I wish I would have paid more attention to history in school. I remember in high school, one of my favorite classes was advanced world history. I couldn't tell you what I learned. I have some vague recollections, but, you know, and adult education would be a nice thing. I'd go back and do that. Yeah. All right. So here we are. We've got a few minutes left. Couple of things. I'm noticing in the chat room that everybody's talking about the debate tonight. We are in debate season. So I mentioned, of course, that in Arizona, Katie Hobbs is refusing to debate Carrie Lake. And I understand, but it leaves her open for criticism, which there's no room there for any mess up. There's no room for that. So I don't know. But all I know is Katie Hobbs has got to win this election. So, you know, good luck to all of us on that. So tonight, Herschel Walker and Raphael Warnock are debating. Those of you who said it's not being carried anywhere nationally, you are correct. I see that all of the local Georgia TV stations are carrying it, and many of them stream. So what I offered to the chat room is I'll pull it up in here. I've got to be in the other room. I've got 20 things going on today, believe it or not. But I will get it started so that I stream the audio. I'll put up a graphic and I'll stream the audio, at least that way. Hopefully YouTube won't copyright violate me, but I'll open up a window and I'll stream it here. So at least you could listen. You have a place to listen because there is not a national feed for a broadcast as far as I know. So I will do that. Diane said, okay, apparently you can see the debate on WJBF's YouTube channel. If you like, I'll run it from here. So you can see it. Uh-oh, I think I just screwed something up. I hope I didn't just kill our broadcast. Oh, man, I'm just a bowl of problems today. All right, so we'll do that. It starts at 7 p.m. Eastern, so I'll get the stream going, and you can watch it from here. Last night, there were a couple of other debates. I think they were last night. In Wisconsin, Mandela Barnes and Ron Johnson debated. Some of it was kind of unintentionally humorous, like this clip. So Ron Johnson, it's like a comedy of errors with those people. I do not know how they keep getting elected because, well, here's the clip that I think went viral from the Ron Johnson Mandela Barnes debate. It's Ron Johnson answering this question.
The Ukrainian people, what we want. They're defending their children, their freedom. I think it is good for us freedom-loving peoples to hang together and provide them the defensive weaponry so they can defend their territory. But again, I want a full accounting.
Oops.
And in response to the wild charge of Lieutenant Governor Barnes, the FBI set me up with a corrupt briefing and then leaked that to smear me. He is referring to corruption with the FBI, which I've been trying to uncover and expose.
Ron Johnson there said the FBI set him up, and the audience for the debate laughed. They laughed at him. Robert called in from Naples, and here's the thing. When I play audio off that computer, it comes up on the same pot that the phone comes up on, so when someone calls in on the line, you can't hear the audio. So it sounds like dead air. But Robert, hi, you're on.
No, you did me a favor. I don't want to hear Ron Johnson. Thank you. Nancy Pelosi. You know, this is something that I think we all knew deep inside that this was who she was. I mean, she's always been tough. I mean, she got the ACA done. She knows how to count votes. She knows how to get people in line. She was always a badass, you know. And I love her for it. I mean, and I think we're lucky to have her.
You know,
I think we're unlucky that she's old.
And you Robert,
know, I don't mean it in a bad way, but
no.
Go ahead.
You haven't been listening to the show very long, so you don't know of my history with Nancy Pelosi. I used to be a fan because she used to be a progressive, and then she got more and more not progressive, and I got more and more frustrated with her. So, I think she needs to retire. I think it's time for her to move on and let the next generation take over. It's their future that they're fighting for. Nancy has done her thing. It's time for her to go home. But that said, I'm glad she was there on January 6th because she's a fucking badass. And she took control like nobody else did.
Right. You know, when the walls were literally caving in, she stood up and she said, bring him here. Tell him to come here. I'll kick his ass. You know, she says, I'll go to jail.
I'll kick his ass. I love that. That was my favorite quote of the whole thing. That was just perfect. And then there's one point where she says, so I just got off the phone with the vice president. And Chuck Schumer says, I just spoke to the VP-elect. And Nancy Pelosi gives him this look like, you got to be fucking kidding me. All right, whatever. So I spoke to the vice president. I mean, she's talking about matters of life and death. I'm sorry, but Kamala Harris had nothing to do with anything on that day. And for Chuck Schumer to chime in and say, well, I just spoke to the VP-elect, Nancy Pelosi rightfully looked at him like, what the fuck, buddy? And then she went on, moved on with her, you know.
No, I know. You know, I had a conversation with a friend of mine who's called the shows or like I do, and she didn't like when I attacked Chuck. She's like, oh, he was strong. I go, no, listen, I actually made a tweet, but I'm in Twitter jail now. I don't know what I did, but I'm in jail now.
Oh, God.
I can't even activate the thing because I forgot what email I used on this one. So anyways, but my thing was, and maybe I'll text it to you, is that Chuck Schumer, he's in panic mode. It's not in his DNA. Where you see in Nancy's persona, that's her DNA. That's who she's always been. Chuck is playing the part. I mean, don't get me wrong. I understand he's nervous. I would be nervous too in that situation.
Right.
But I think he just tried to man up on that in that situation. It didn't really work for him. Like, as he looked at
right.
it. Like,
well, he also kept looking at the camera. He also, you know, yeah. he was very cognizant that cameras were on and he was playing to the camera.
Right.
She wasn't. She was trying to save the country.
Nicole, he's never said go fuck yourself to anybody. He's never. It's not in him. He can't do it. You know, he's a gentleman. He's smart. I'm not taking anything away from Chuck. But yep. what I'm saying is that's not who he was. It wasn't that he was acting. He was afraid.
Of course, they were all afraid. I was afraid.
But you know who was a tough guy? And I gotta give it to him. And I hate the motherfucker. Is the turtle mother?
Mitch McConnell.
He says, "No, we're gonna finish this. We're gonna go vote. We're gonna do this."
Yeah.
You know, Nicole, that night I went to bed at 10 o'clock. I didn't know if I'd wake up to America.
Yeah.
Night, you know, because then when I heard that they voted and they you know, and Joe Biden is gonna be our president. I said, okay, we live another day.
You know?
That's good.
And that's why, hey, Robert, I'm going to run. Your phone's really noisy, and I got some other stuff to take care of. But thank you for calling. Glad you're safe in Naples. Thanks for chiming in. Again, I was glad Nancy Pelosi was there. Chuck Schumer, I would rather see, again, I'd rather see young blood take over leadership positions in the Democratic Party. Look, I'm older. Enough of the baby boomers and before. We did what we did. Look, I'll quote this Kevin Gilbert song. The boomers had everything. The song is Goodness Gracious. The baby boomers had a thing. They wasted everything. I'll have to find it. I can't do it in midstream. Anyway, they had their chance. I should say we. I'm at the very tail end of the baby boom. Let the next generation take over. It's their future. We don't. Our future is, you know, the great beyond. So, just saying. All right, I got to show you this picture. I'm totally changing streams here, but this was in Business Insider. It is an article, I guess, from Business Insider. The headline reads: Two Finnish guys annexed a Russian diplomat's parking spot by painting it with the Ukrainian flag. This is in Finland, and these two guys went to the, I guess, the Russian, is it the embassy or the let me see if I can, I can't even read it, the Russian consulate, and they took the main diplomat's parking space and painted the Ukrainian flag on it and said that they announced that they're annexing this Russian property for Finland. And the city said they would not paint over what they called the protest. That's like yes men worthy, right? That's just so good. Thank you, Bella Lagrisi. Bella got the lyrics for me, of apathy, goodness gracious, of apathy. I sing the baby boomers had it all and wasted everything. Now recess is almost over and they won't get off the swing. Won't get off the swing. Goodness gracious. We came in at the end. No sex that isn't dangerous. No money left to spend. We're the cleanup crew for parties. We were too young to attend. Goodness gracious me. That's what I couldn't just pull off the top of my head. Thank you, Bella. Those lyrics are perfect. And yes, I'm a baby boomer, but I get it. We blew it. My generation blew it. We had it all and we wasted everything. I should go out with that song again. Maybe I will. Because it so fits. So my hope is that young people, so look, AOC is the perfect representative of the next generation. We need more of her. We need young people to get out and kick some ass. Okay, so tonight, the Mandela Barnes, Herschel Walker, Raphael Warnock debate. I don't know, chat room, have we decided? Am I stringing? What song is that? That is Goodness Gracious by Kevin Gilbert. And I'll play it at the end. No, you know what? I can't. I got to run out of here on time tonight because I got too many things. I'll share it with you maybe next week. But yes, look him up. Kevin Gilbert, Goodness Gracious. I'm telling you, it's a theme song for our times. And Kevin Gilbert died in 1995, 96, I think. So he was prescient, that is for sure. All right, so that debate tonight. Last night, I played you the one Ron Johnson clip. Let me play you another clip. In Michigan, it was a debate among the two gubernatorial candidates, Gretchen Whitmer, who is the governor now, the incumbent, and Tudor Dixon, who is her opponent. Tudor Dixon is the woman's name. This is part of her closing statement.
The governor would like to forget you to forget how hard the last 4 years have been with Gretchen Whitmer.
What?
She's shown us who she is.
What?
She stood on this very stage and said she wouldn't raise taxes. And she tried and tried and tried again to raise your taxes over and over.
She
did? Also said that she cares about women, but she would gladly put little boys in your daughter's locker room. She also said she cares about parents. But she hasn't stood for parents who have said, why do we have adults whispering sex and gender into
the
ears?
You get the idea. That's what her debate, that was her closing argument. Just, you know, more lies and stuff. What I want to do is show you a commercial that she is up on TV with. Again, this is the challenger to Michigan's governor, a woman named Tudor Dixon. I just reported. I don't make them up. So, but I want you to get a load of this. And for those of you listening to an audio stream and you're not going to see it, you can hear bad acting when you hear it. But let me just tell you, the actors in this case are wearing motorcycle gear, like Harley gear. They're all easily in their 60s. And you could tell none of them have ever ridden a bike. Okay, so wait till you hear the audio. Oh, this is grade A acting. Political ad for the opponent in the Republican in the Michigan gubernatorial race.
Hey, have you seen the TV ads with the governor talking about the great things she's done for Michigan?
She's a liar. Whitmer can say what she wants, but we live here. Just look around, man.
During COVID, Whitmer locked down businesses like the Owosso Barber and put one woman from Holland in jail.
What?
Oh, yeah.
What?
3,000 restaurants closed. And she's pro-business?
Yeah, right.
And what about those higher gas and food prices?
Our schools were closed for almost 2 years.
Oh, my
Poor
God.
Kids.
You got to see
of
this.
Kids, Whitmer says she's going to work like hell to keep killing babies.
Oh, yeah.
And she put COVID patients in Graham's nursing home.
What?
Graham died alone.
Okay. I'm voting for the other chick. What's her name?
Tudor Dixon.
Okay, let's roll.
Watch out for potholes. Whitmer never kept her promise to
fix the damn roads.
That has to be the worst commercial I've ever seen. Oh, Caroline in the chat room saying, oh no, not that ad again. You've seen it? I'm sorry. I didn't know other people are playing it. I just saw that. And I once I picked myself up from rolling on the floor laughing, I thought I need to share that with you guys. Oh my God, that's hysterical. Wow. Yeah, it looks like a bad SNL skit. Absolutely. And again, the only thing worse than that is what she actually said in the debate. So let me play one other clip. And again, this one is from last night, Mandela Barnes and Ron Johnson. I'll even give you the video on this one. Because the question was, the last question. And they were asked, say something admirable, something you admire about your opponent. So it starts with Mandela Barnes, and he says this.
You know, the senator has proven to be a family man, and I think that's admirable. You know, that's absolutely to be respected. He speaks about his family. He's done a lot to provide for them. I absolutely respect that.
Mr. Johnson.
I mean, likewise. I appreciate the fact that Lieutenant Governor Barnes had loving parents, a school teacher, father worked third shift, so he had good upbringing. I guess what puzzles me about that is with that upbringing, why is he turned against America? I mean, why does he find the calling America awful?
Somehow,
it puzzles me. We did not.
I said,
please,
we
audience.
Said something admirable, and it is now time. Somehow we have made it to the end.
Okay, so something admirable, and Ron Johnson still had to be a dick. Just a dick. Oh, and with that, don't vote for Ron Johnson. Come on, man. What was that?
Come on, man.
All right, so programming note. Monday, You've asked, I deliver. Monday, the whole hour, Wendell Potter will be here. Wendell Potter, the health insurance industry whistleblower, who has gone on to inform us about the evils of Medicare Advantage and all the other scams that the insurance industry is playing on us. Wendell, open enrollment starts soon. They're pushing this Advantage crap. Wendell Potter will be here for the entire hour on Monday, and he will take questions. He will answer calls from you guys. Now, it'll be a challenge because, again, I don't have a producer or screener, but we'll do it. We'll get it done. It'll work the same way we do now, so you got to be fast on the dial. But I know you have a lot of questions about Medicare Advantage and Medicare and health insurance, so Wendell Potter, Monday, he'll be here, okay? It's a good way to start the week, I think. And with that, we're done. Thanks for listening, everybody. Sorry for the technical problems. And I can't even find the words today. My God, I need a weekend. It's the cross I bear. One of these days I'll get it together and then it'll be time to retire. All right, everybody. I'll leave you with the news. Thank you for listening. If you're in South Florida, come out tomorrow to Fort Lauderdale to Riverwalk Park across from the Museum of Discovery and Science. I'll be out there. There's the fall festival. I'll have my artwork and stuff and be hanging out. So if you're here, come be hang. Otherwise, I'll see you Monday. Thanks for listening, you guys. Have a great, great weekend. All right. And I will try to stream the audio of the debate tonight starting at 7 Eastern here on the YouTube channel and on my audio stream if it works. So I'll try that for you. All right. Now, the news.
For Nicole Sandler, what's news from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The House Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 Capitol attack voted unanimously Thursday to subpoena the former president. The vote came at the end of the committee's ninth and possibly final public hearing and set up an unprecedented potential showdown with a former president. Vice Chair Liz Cheney said the panel needs to hear, quote, the testimony under oath of January 6th central player, as they presented facts that Trump was the one pushing the false claim that the 2020 election was stolen from him and urging supporters to fight to overturn his privately acknowledged loss. Cheney saying the vast weight of the evidence so far has shown us that the central cause of January 6th was one man, Donald Trump, who many others followed. So the hearing summarized the investigation's findings thus far, focusing on Trump's role leading up to the day. They introduced a lot of new evidence and video not previously seen by the public. A few important takeaways. Committee member Adam Schiff.
Multiple users online were targeting members of Congress, instructing others to march into the chambers on January 6th and make sure they know who to fear. In this report received on December 26th, a Secret Service field office relayed a tip that had been received by the FBI. The Proud Boys plan to march armed into D.C. They think that they will have a large enough group to march into D.C. armed and will outnumber the police so they can't be stopped. The source went on to say their plan is to literally kill people. Please, please take this tip seriously and investigate further.
Further, recorded testimony from former aides showed that Trump privately said that he knew he lost to Joe Biden.
I remember maybe a week after the election was called, I popped into the Oval just to like give the president the headlines and see how he was doing. And he was looking at the TV and he said, "Can you believe I lost to this effing guy?"
And there was a lot of evidence showing that the plan all along was to declare victory whether he won or not. Here's Steve Bannon talking to, quote, associates from China.
And what Trump's going to do is just declare victory, right? He's going to declare victory. And that doesn't mean he's the winner. He's just going to say he's the winner. More of our people vote early that count. Theirs vote in mail. And so they're going to have a natural disadvantage, and Trump's going to take advantage of it. That's our strategy. He's going to declare himself a winner. So when you wake up Wednesday morning, it's going to be a firestorm. Also, if Trump is losing by 10 or 11 o'clock at night, it's going to be even crazier. No, because he's going to sit right there and say they stole it.
I'm
directing the Attorney General to shut down all ballot places in all 50 states. It's going to be no. He's not going out easy. If Biden's winning, Trump is going to do some crazy shit.
What more do you need to hear? But there was more. A lot more. The committee also showed video of top lawmakers, including Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, begging law enforcement to stop the rioters, despite claims by Republicans that she did nothing of the sort. By the way, Nancy Pelosi, official badass. And I mean that in the best possible way. Even the Wall Street Journal editorial board is saying enough is enough. They write on Friday that there is more than enough revealed so far to hold the former president accountable. What the committee has accomplished is to cement the facts surrounding Mr. Trump's recklessness after November 3rd and his dereliction of duty on January 6th. The Justice Department and Mr. Trump's own campaign repeatedly told him that his fraud claims were without basis. Whether it was willful blindness or an intentional strategy, he kept repeating them. That day, he riled up the crowd and urged it to march on the Capitol. Just some of that Wall Street Journal editorial. And on Friday morning, the former guy responded with a 14-page rambling letter to the committee chair, Benny Thompson, littered with lies. I'm not even going to waste your time quoting any of it. He offers no facts, no defense. He just whines and lies. What else is new? In other Trump-related news from Thursday, the Supreme Court rejected his request to let the special master Raymond Deary review those classified documents that the FBI seized from Mar-a-Lago in August. The Supreme Court issued a one-word response: denied. In other big news on Thursday, a South Florida jury recommended that the shooter who killed 17 people and injured another 17 in Parkland, Florida, at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, be spared the death penalty and instead serve life in prison without the possibility of parole. The shooter already pleaded guilty. This three-month trial was only to determine whether he would spend the rest of his life in jail or be sentenced to death. Under Florida law, only one juror needed to say no to the death penalty for that option to be taken off the table. Well, according to a motion filed late Thursday, prosecutors want to interview one of those jurors who, after the verdict was read, said that during deliberations, she received what she perceived to be a threat from a fellow juror while in the jury room. The juror, Denise Cunha, sent a letter Thursday saying that she angered fellow panelists when she made it clear she would not vote to execute Cruz. She wrote, quote, "The deliberations were very tense and some jurors became extremely unhappy once I mentioned that I would vote life. Threatening a juror under Florida law is a third-degree felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison. A hearing is scheduled for Friday afternoon. Meanwhile, the official sentencing now is set for November 1st to allow the victims and families to speak." Speaking of mass shootings, no surprise that after the Parkland murderer's life was spared, you guessed it, another one. This time, five people were shot and killed along a nature trail in Raleigh, North Carolina, on Thursday night. One of the victims was an off-duty police officer. At least two other people were injured and have been hospitalized, one in critical condition. 5 hours later, a suspect was arrested. He's a 15-year-old white boy. I have no more words. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.
That they spoke to a blue state office and had to explain the differences between opportunist burning and looting during the Black Lives Matter protest and the insurgent mob whose purpose was to prevent the execution of democratic processes at the behest of a sitting president. The emailer wrote that they recovered the information from first and secondhand conversations with FBI employees. So you have it in writing and you have testimony from conversation with FBI employees. The email was recently released through a Freedom of Information Act request. It was labeled an external email that suggests the emailer was no longer an active FBI agent, thank God. The emailer described their first unit, indicating that they have a history within the FBI. And of note, the FBI Agents Association, the FBIAA, an organization that supports active and former FBI agents, quote, does not comment on ongoing investigations. That's what Brian O'Hare, the group's president, said. He said, quote, I will say that FBI agents understand the importance of separating their own personal views from their professional work. That was in a statement to Axios. The FBI, well, they've declined to comment. So the bigger picture is the FBI at large sees the January 6th riots as an example of domestic terrorism. That's what Director Christopher Wray said in May 2021, and that was before the Senate Judiciary Committee in his testimony there. He said the rioters were on the same level with ISIS and homegrown violent extremists. By the way, they have found arsenals of weapons either there or planning to bring there. So for people out there that say there were no weapons, that's a lie. And two, for people like Ron Johnson and others who either need to smoke way more weed or smoked way too much, this was not tourism. It was